anticipated the potential problem. This was an explicit requirement in NASA's commercial crew contracts. But it was also not in keeping with Rutan's philosophy. The old-school designer once claimed that if space is going to be cheap, it has to be stick and rudder. The accident sent a different message. Space travel was too fast, too complicated, and too dangerous for human hands alone. Branson had clearly been stung by media criticism that suggested his ego was behind the accident, but he was using the peak to press on. He decided that the only way forward would be to bring the entire operation in-house, as the other rocket billionaires had. Two of the earliest SpaceX employees, Chris Thompson and Tim Buzza, had joined Virgin in 2012 and 2014, respectively, sharing their approach to spacecraft design. Virgin had already been in the process of buying out Scaled's share of their joint venture, the space company. Now there would be a clear chain of command, with test pilots dedicated to Virgin Galactic's projects only, not shared among multiple new vehicles. The next Spaceship Two, already under construction, would be carefully re-examined for the human factors that had been left out of the first version. A former U.S. Air Force test pilot was put in charge of pilot safety. By 2017, a new Spaceship Two, the VSS Unity, was undergoing glide testing and aiming for a return to powered flight in 2018. The company's optimism had returned. It raised more money from investors in the Middle East and began to prepare its team for the move to New Mexico to begin normal operations. But just as the Apollo program had overtaken the work of the rocket plane test pilots in the 1960s, vertical launching rocket companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin had stolen Virgin Galactic's thunder. The XPRIZE win that had catalyzed the company seemed as distant as the idea of a space line carrying paying passengers around the world. Jeff Bezos's space company was even older than Virgin Galactic, but his tight-lipped approach protected him from accusations of exaggeration. Yet something, whether it was competitive instincts, the challenge of recruiting the best talent, or sheer pride, compelled him to join the mobs on Twitter in November 2015 to show off the rarest of beasts that Blue Origin had birthed. The New Shepard's reusable booster stage had made it back to Earth in one piece after its second test flight. Blue had rebounded quickly from the loss of the first booster during the company's spring flight, producing another flight-ready vehicle. Once again, Bezos arrived at his Texas ranch and joined Blue's development team in their small control room. The New Shepard runs largely on internal computers, part of the company's policy of trying to get humans out of the control chain wherever they could to improve reliability. On the second trial, the rocket once again took off with a blast of its single engine and ascended to the edge of space. This time, the hydraulics held up throughout the entire descent back to its landing pad. New Shepard's spindly landing legs unfolded from recessed compartments on the booster's sides and supported the rocket as it hit the ground. The celebrating team, drenched in champagne, had done what no one had ever done before: launch a rocket to the edge of space and bring it back down again in one piece. The same quibbles over suborbital and orbital velocities as the last launch applied here, inspiring a barrage of skeptical tweets from Musk. He noted the record of the X-15 spaceplane and defended SpaceX's Grasshopper program and the fact that his orbital rockets had arrived at precise spots above the ocean to prepare for sea landing. But to no avail, Musk had shared videos of his rockets exploding. Bezos had film of his rocket landing gently on the ground, with him standing next to it, and all the bragging rights this entailed. The general public did not honor the finer distinctions about orbital velocities. It was the first time that Blue had piped SpaceX to the post. This news came as SpaceX was winding up its investigations into the CRS-7 explosion and applying for a license to return to operational flight. The company planned to launch satellites for Orbcomm before the end of the year. It was the second half of a constellation the company had originally sold to fly on the Falcon 1 several years before. SpaceX would use the opportunity to debut a new, upgraded version of the Falcon 9 called Full Thrust that promised 30% more power thanks to larger fuel tanks and modified engines. This extra fuel could be the difference between the reusable booster crash landing and making a graceful dismount. SpaceX was granted a license to launch its rocket just a few days before its window opened. Just as important, it received permission to try and land its first stage at Cape Canaveral. This was a very different task from landing it on an autonomous barge 100 miles out to sea. Though the landing pad at the Cape would be clear, there would be people and expensive infrastructure within miles of where the rocket was intended to touch down. An error would be disastrous. After all, a rocket descending was just a missile without a warhead. Considering that their last flight, less than 6 months earlier, had been a failure, SpaceX's executives were making a big ask of their regulators at the FAA and the U.S. Air Force team responsible for the range at Cape Canaveral. They were told to go ahead. As the rocket ignited, it seemed as if everyone watching was holding their breath or clenching their stomach until the rocket passed the moment where the CRS-7 vehicle had exploded mid-flight. This time, the struts and everything else held together. At stage separation, the 11 satellites were sent on their way. This was the primary mission, and in one sense, this was all that mattered. They had proven that the Falcon 9 could be trusted to bring cargo to space again, and finally completed the build-out of a satellite constellation. But for Musk and his engineers, not to mention all the fans watching on YouTube, the real prize would be bringing the booster rocket back down to Earth. It was important enough that Musk personally delayed the mission by 24 hours because SpaceX's computer simulations predicted a 10% higher chance of a successful landing. Now it was all in the rocket's hands as it flew itself with the software that Blackmore and his team had written. Operating the fins and legs and valves that technicians had cleaned, tested, and double-checked ahead of the mission. 50 miles above the Atlantic, the booster fired its engines to do a backflip and returned to the Florida coast from which it had departed just 4 minutes before. Roughly 8 minutes after liftoff, the engines restarted for a third time to slow the rocket through atmosphere reentry. 2 minutes later, it lit the sky around the Cape with orange fire and lowered itself to the ground with agonizing slowness. Settling down, wreathed in smoke. When it blew away, there was the 20-story tall machine standing proudly. At SpaceX headquarters, the excited screams of the staff reached hysterical proportions. They had landed the rocket. This was also a first, a vertical takeoff rocket delivering cargo to orbit and then returning to land under control. In an industry that was afraid of failed tests, it's hard to understate the chutzpah of returning to flight with a mission that tested three things: a brand new rocket, a landing maneuver that had never been successfully demonstrated, and, after the Orbcomm satellites were deployed, the ability of the second stage of the rocket to ignite again. The latter was a crucial capability if SpaceX was to launch geostationary satellites. Bezos couldn't help but weigh in on SpaceX's accomplishment. "Congrats, SpaceX, on landing Falcon's suborbital booster stage," he tweeted. "Welcome to the club." The sly reference to a suborbital booster stage couldn't have been intended to do anything other than tweak Musk, who had been at pains to note that the Falcon 9 first stage could reach orbit on its own, even without the second stage. The SpaceX founder was busy racing to the landing zone to examine his booster and did not reply. But in the meantime, the Amazon billionaire received a barrage of salty replies from Twitter users, accusing him of everything from jealousy to misunderstanding how rockets work. Regardless of where you come down on the more impressive achievement, being the first to land any rocket at all, or landing an orbital-class rocket, it's clear that the two principles were fully enmeshed in a full-on reusable rocket rivalry. Bezos would take the next major step of actually reusing a landed booster. SpaceX brought the Orbcomm rocket back to its headquarters in Hawthorne, setting it up outside the main building as a totem and memento of what had been done so far. The first Dragon space capsule was already hanging above the cafeteria. Blue Origin, however, put its used booster back to work almost immediately. In 2016, it would fly and land the same vehicle four more times, gathering critical data about its flight profile and what it took to refurbish the vehicle for reflight. After each one, employees painted a tortoise rearing proudly on its hind legs on the new Shepherd's hatch, embodying the company's step-by-step, ferociously motto. During the final test in October, the Blue Origin team demonstrated the new Shepherd's abort system, proving that if something did go wrong with its rocket, the humans on top could jettison their capsule and fly to safety. The mid-flight abort involved shooting the capsule's emergency rocket engines directly into the top of the booster, so it was not expected to survive. It did anyway, flying back to its pad in another proof of the resiliency of the hardware and the capacity of the flight software. In 2017, Bezos and his team would be awarded the prestigious Robert J. Collier Award, recognizing the new Shepherd as the greatest achievement in aeronautics or aeronautics in America during the preceding year. After five successful flights, Blue retired the booster and entered into another one of its regular dormant periods. It would not launch another rocket for well over a year, focusing instead on more hardware development. It looks to me that the original tests are what we call developmental tests, one engineer with close ties to the company told me. Now they are going to move into operational testing, which is what you do on the operational vehicle to make sure that you have a fleet you can start flying tourists on. Musk's team weren't resting on their laurels either, and all of their tests made money for the company. The ground landing was all well and good, but for reusability to be useful in the long run, the company would need to perfect the seagoing landing scheme they had battled Bezos for in the courts. In January and March 2016, the company attempted to land two more boosters on the drone ships. The first, a comparatively easy flight to low Earth orbit, almost went swimmingly. But one of the landing legs came unlocked and the rocket slowly tipped over. The second flight was returning from a high-velocity mission to sling a satellite toward a high orbit. That rocket smacked into the ship with punishing force. Each time the reusability team learned more about their vehicle, playing with different ways to balance engine thrust and maneuverability while conserving propellant. Finally, in April 2016, SpaceX landed a booster on a drone ship following a mission to the International Space Station for NASA. Three more would follow suit after later launches, including two returning from high-velocity missions to geostationary orbits, and another would land on the ground pad. All in all, the company returned five boosters during that calendar year. The challenge was still in preserving enough margin from the tough job of going to space to get back down without losing control. SpaceX's engineers focused on how to cram more power into their vehicle so they could make reusability financially sustainable. Just as important as innovation for the company was reliability, expressed in the form of frequent launches. By the end of that summer, SpaceX had launched eight successful missions, each of which generated valuable revenue and useful data and cleared the decks for more jobs ahead. If it could launch just 4 more missions by the end of the year, it would match United Launch Alliance's 12 missions for the year. To genuinely innovate and to equal an established incumbent for productivity would be a dual achievement for SpaceX. That September, the company's operations team at the Cape prepared for a launch on behalf of an Israeli satellite maker. SpaceX's rockets usually go through a pre-mission static fire, the procedure in which they burn through a full duration while held down by clamps. A dress rehearsal for space. Most companies would do this before putting the payload on top of the rocket. SpaceX, in its endless quest to save time and money, had already mounted the satellite in its protective fairing on top of the rocket. Pumps began loading fuel into the rocket ahead of the test. Without warning, the Falcon 9 exploded. The rocket, the $175 million satellite on top, and the launch pad that SpaceX had developed at a cost of $25 million were all consumed by flames. Chapter 15. Rocket Billionaires. I know perfectly well that the hard-headed businessmen who, after all, are really the ones who put research developments on a going basis, are convinced only by final accomplishments, and are not influenced by theories alone, however sound they may be. Robert Goddard. A failure during the intensity of launch is one thing. A mysterious explosion during a routine propellant top-off is a murkier problem. What could have happened to create such a mess? Conspiracy theories abounded, especially after SpaceX requested access to the rooftop of a facility operated by its rival, United Launch Alliance, that was within sight of the accident. The U.S. Air Force would find nothing related to the fire during its inspection. Once again, SpaceX was in scramble mode, trying to pin down what had gone wrong during the incident. Once again, classified as a mishap because no one was injured. Safety procedures require a clear pad during fueling. The explosion, really just a fast fire, Musk mused online, had repercussions that signaled just how far SpaceX's influence reached into the global economy. An Israeli company called Spacecom had built the doomed satellite, called Amos-6. It was designed to provide internet access to the Middle East and Africa. Eutelsat, a European telecommunications firm, had leased some of its capacity. More unusually, so had Facebook, the American social media giant. Facebook and its largest rival, Google, were focused on growth, but adding new users was becoming more about increasing basic internet access than convincing current netizens to use their services. Just like the founders of Microsoft had before them in the 1990s, Facebook and Google began to look up at the sky. Google's Moonshot Factory, the division where it developed risky futuristic businesses with its endless stream of advertising dollars, invested in high-altitude balloons and developed plans for a satellite constellation. Facebook's strategy included solar-powered planes that could fly for days at a time, providing internet access to people below. But for right now, Amos-6 was a more straightforward way to boost internet access for markets in Africa. In booming metropolises like Lagos, Nigeria, and Nairobi, Kenya, broadband penetration was low, but people enthusiastically adopted mobile phones in their daily lives. Facebook's effort to increase access was often pitched as philanthropy or corporate social responsibility, but there was real money at stake for the firm. Not just American, but also European and Chinese companies were eager to win African consumers over to more data-intensive services, if the telecom infrastructure could be put in place. The pre-flight destruction of AMO-6 was a dent in Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg's hopes to make a splash serving internet from space. On the day of the incident, he was making a surprise tour of African tech hubs, one whose timing on the day of the satellite launch was probably not coincidental. Writing from Nairobi, the internet billionaire said he was deeply disappointed to hear that SpaceX's launch failure destroyed our satellite that would have provided connectivity to so many entrepreneurs and everyone else across the continent. Disappointment reached further across the globe. When the Falcon 9 burst into flames, Spacecom was in negotiations to be purchased by a Chinese telecom firm for $285 million. The deal was contingent, in part, on the revenue from an operational AMO-6. Now the company would lose money, even after insurance, due to delays and replacement costs. Their merger was scotched, though China's space ambitions were not. The burgeoning global power had sunk serious resources into its space program in recent decades, developing reliable launch vehicles and spacecraft. Even if its approach to safety was what you might expect in an essentially authoritarian country. In 2011, it had launched its first temporary space lab, Tiangong 1. When AMO-6 was consumed by flames in September 2016, the Chinese were months away from sending two Taikonauts to Tiangong 2, a larger orbital lab. These actions underscored the fact that the United States, the pioneers of human spaceflight, still did not have the ability to fly astronauts. The U.S. government was still paying the Russians, all geopolitical tensions aside, to fly Americans, as well as their foreign partners from the European Union and Japan, up to the ISS. Russia had clearly noticed that NASA had no other options. A seat in the Soyuz capsule had once cost as little as $21 million, but by 2016, Roscosmos was planning to charge as much as $81 million. That was more than the price of a single Falcon 9 commercial launch. The total cost of relying on the Russians between 2006 and 2018 was forecast to be as much as $3.4 billion. The financial pressure, plus humiliation as other nations pushed past them in space, fell hard on NASA and the two companies racing to get Americans back up to the space station through the Commercial Crew Program, SpaceX and Boeing. Neither was on schedule. Having to spend another 6 months figuring out what had gone wrong with its rocket wasn't going to make things any easier for SpaceX. The company quickly zeroed in on the source of the problem. To increase the power of the Falcon 9 second stage, SpaceX engineers were super-chilling the liquid oxygen, LOX, that combusted along with the rocket fuel down to minus 340 degrees Fahrenheit. This made it denser and allowed them to pack more into the tank. Musk said that using the super-chilled fuel was key to full reusability of the rockets. If the second stage could fly further on its own, the booster could conserve more fuel for successful landing attempts. In order for the LOX to remain cold ahead of takeoff, the ground crew would begin filling the tanks just 30 minutes prior to flight, a procedure known as load and go. SpaceX had experimented with different techniques for loading propellant into the Falcon 9 throughout 2016. This led to launches being scrubbed at the last minute when pressures or temperatures were outside nominal levels. It was another shared challenge faced by rocket companies pushing the edges of performance. The technicians behind the computer-controlled plumbing that precisely fueled the Falcon 9 were distant cousins of the X-Prize-winning flight engineers who awoke at 2 a.m. to slosh Spaceship One's nitrous oxide around in a tank until it reached the correct temperature. Trial and error eventually left SpaceX with a process that it seemed could reliably load the super-chilled propellant. Outside observers were fretting about this approach when it came to SpaceX's plan to fly humans. A NASA advisory board, led by retired astronaut Thomas Stafford, who had flown Apollo 10 around the moon, wrote a warning letter to Bill Gerstenmaier saying that load and go would be unacceptable when SpaceX started flying with people on board. There is a unanimous and strong feeling by the committee that scheduling the crew to be on board the Dragon spacecraft prior to loading oxidizer into the rocket is contrary to booster safety criteria that has been in place for over 50 years. Only after the booster is fully fueled and stabilized are the few essential people allowed near it, Stafford wrote. This wasn't entirely true. As SpaceX engineers pointed out to me, the space shuttle, though fueled before the crew boarded, had its propellant tanks constantly replenished until just minutes prior to ignition, as liquid hydrogen and oxygen boiled off. After the AMOS 6 accident, a different NASA safety panel warned that analyzing the super-chilled fueling system would not be a trivial effort, and that NASA shouldn't let concerns about budget or schedule force it to rush into using a novel technology that it didn't completely understand. Systems often display emergent behavior once they are used in the actual operational environment, the advisors noted dryly. In the months after the mishap, SpaceX was true to its experimental ethos and began attempting to replicate the accident at its McGregor test facility. By the end of October, it had a theory about what had happened. It centered on carbon fiber tanks known as composite overwrapped pressure vessels, or COPVs. Each COPV had an aluminum liner and held helium that, during flight, was pumped into the propulsion system to keep LOX flowing into the engines at high pressure. During the disastrous CRS-7 flight in 2015, it was one of the helium tanks that had broken loose when the strut holding it in place snapped. Investigators were able to rule out the same fault in this case. SpaceX was pushing the limits of COPV technology. Space engineers had long known that the carbon composites could interact explosively with liquid oxygen under the wrong conditions. Ultimately, SpaceX's experiments found that the super-chilled LOX in the Falcon 9 had soaked into the composite wrapping. In some cases, the oxygen grew cold enough to actually change its physical state from a liquid to a solid. During loading, as the helium filled the COPV, the slushy oxygen pooled in small dents or deformities in the aluminum liner, known as buckles. Semi-solid oxygen collecting in the buckles could be forced against the woven fibers of the composite. If they cracked or rubbed together, a spark could, and apparently did, ignite the entire engine. The reason that that happened was because there was a big push to compress the timelines and go faster and faster and faster, a former SpaceX employee told me. Less time on the pad meant cheaper and faster launches, and the company hoped to launch a rocket within an hour. That required pumping liquid helium, rather than warmer compressed gas, into the rocket to fill the tanks more quickly. They just learned some lessons that they hadn't discovered through any kind of test program in Texas. They loaded fast enough, they had a problem with the rocket, boom. Failed experiments with composite tanks had been a key reason for NASA canceling a prototype replacement for the space shuttle, the Lockheed Martin X-33, in 2000. Pushing the envelope is a risky business, however, and as SpaceX worked to wring every ounce of power out of its vehicles to reach its goal of reusability, its margin for error declined. Nonetheless, after the expensive accident, SpaceX didn't abandon the program. Instead, it announced that it would revert to a helium loading procedure that had worked more than 700 times and redesign the COPVs to prevent the buckles. The accident had done significant damage to the launch pad, SLC-40, and that would require time and money to repair, leaving the company temporarily without an East Coast launch facility. They were still refurbishing the second launch pad, SLC-39A, leased from NASA 3 years before. Just as in 2015, SpaceX had been aiming to increase its launch cadence and beat ULA for most American orbital launches. And once again, a public and embarrassing failure had left SpaceX behind the eight ball, though it had managed to launch two more rockets than in the prior year. Some questioned whether Musk, now running not just SpaceX, Tesla, and SolarCity, but also two new startups focused on artificial intelligence and underground tunnels, was too distracted. Taking the opposite tack, others argued that he was driving his team too hard to do what could not be done. Stories of SpaceX employees burning out over time abound, but few regret their hard work or Musk's intensity. That's how he thinks. These guys are taking the easy way out. We need to take the hard way, Mueller, his propulsion engineer, said. I've seen that hurt us before. I've seen that fail. But I've also seen where nobody thought it would work, and many times, it was the right decision. Just as pressing as the operational and engineering questions were the concerns about money. Could SpaceX withstand another loss of $250 million or more, the missing revenues associated with 6 months of delayed launches, after their last failure? After the fire, SpaceX's chief financial officer boasted that the company had $10 billion worth of future launches on its manifest, $1 billion in cash on hand, and no debt. Failures were part of the rocket business. While the loss of the SpaceX mission to the space station in 2015 punished the firm's bottom line, it had little impact on its value. Fidelity, the enormous mutual fund company, had invested in SpaceX just 6 months before the accident. Its filings afterward showed that the rocket firm's value had increased 15% in just 11 months to almost $12 billion. Since 2012, Musk's company had been in a special class, unicorns, venture-backed firms valued at $1 billion or more by their owners. Now the space startup was considered twice as valuable as United Launch Alliance, which had rejected a takeover bid worth as much as $4 billion in 2015. That was less than Musk's personal stake in his rocket firm, estimated to be worth more than $6 billion. The most apparent reason for this disparity was that ULA was losing the competitive battle. Brett Tobey, the ULA vice president, whose leaked 2016 remarks are a window into the Boeing-Lockheed Ventures thinking, summed up the launch market succinctly. Along came Elon Musk and changed the game completely. Describing ULA's decision to bow out of the bidding for a GPS satellite launch that year, Tobey said, "We saw it as a cost shootout between us and SpaceX, so now we're going to have to figure out how to bid these things at a much lower cost. The government can't just say, you know, ULA's got a great track record. They've done 100 launches. SpaceX's price points are coming down as low as $60 million. The best day you'll see us bid is at $125 million, or twice that number. Add in the capabilities cost, it eclipses $200 million. ULA wasn't alone. Europe's Arianespace faced questions about whether its next-generation vehicle was already obsolete. Orbital, which had replaced the engine in its Antares rocket and returned to flight, was having trouble marketing the rocket commercially and would be purchased for nearly $8 billion by Northrop Grumman in 2017. Yet SpaceX's growing pool of backers were investing in more than just low-cost vehicles. They were investing in the transformative promise of reusability, which seemed tantalizingly close after several successful booster landings. Still, in 2016, rivals never hesitated to point out that the company had not actually flown one of its boosters for a second time, as Blue Origin had with its suborbital New Shepard. Many of SpaceX's private investors were also counting on an entirely different line of business to justify the firm's worth. In late 2014, Musk revealed that SpaceX didn't just want to launch satellites that provided internet service. It wanted to build them, operate them, and profit from them. Naturally, Musk found a rival. The catalyst for this internet satellite project was a gregarious entrepreneur named Greg Wyler, who had a successful career as a telecom investor during the tech boom. In 2003, he had a chance meeting with an official in Rwanda's government. Sensing opportunity, he started a new business that would build out fiber optic internet infrastructure in the East African nation. It also became the major shareholder in the country's largest telecom firm. This was a feel-good project for Wyler and the Rwandans, who saw the internet as a way to establish a footing for their largely rural country in the 21st century. But the realities of installing expensive technology in a poor country quickly caught up with the scheme. Providing internet access at a school without electricity is futile, and lowering the cost of internet access to less than $100 a month is useless if the average annual income is just a few $100. Progress slowed, and Wyler and his firm were scrutinized for promises unfulfilled. In 2006, Rwandan regulators alleged that Wyler's company had tried to transfer its shares in the national telecom firm to a different company and fined them $400,000. Wyler stepped down as CEO in 2006, handing it over to new managers. Wyler doesn't comment on the specifics, except to say that Rwanda's internet infrastructure was far stronger after he left. But he learned at least two lessons. One was that offering expanded internet to developing markets was a pitch that thrilled both potential investors and partners who were now ready to take risks on high-tech ventures abroad, especially those that would be welcomed by local authorities. The internet was not as controversial as resource extraction concessions or low-wage manufacturing, if only because its power to shape political events was only slowly becoming clear. His second key lesson was that putting wires underground was costly and time-consuming. It was no way to bring the information age to sparsely populated areas or those like Rwanda that are far from the undersea cables that link the continents together. Why not just use satellites to do the job of linking the local network to the outside world? In 2007, Wyler co-founded a company called O3B, which stood for The Other 3 Billion, a shorthand for the underserved chunk of the global population it targeted. It would take advantage of the fact that newer, more powerful, and long-lasting satellites were more effective than their predecessors in providing internet links to telecom companies in countries from South Sudan to Madagascar. It found backers, including the European satellite giant SES, the sprawling global internet service provider Liberty Global, and Google. The search giant saw a chance to learn about driving internet access to remote areas and would later consider using the satellites to link up its Wi-Fi broadcasting balloons. Wyler's company endured a few years of tough fundraising, borrowed $1.2 billion, and launched its first four satellites in 2014. It succeeded in attracting a diverse clientele, if not always one that aligned with its stated mission. Alongside Papua New Guinea and Pakistan, O3B found customers that one reporter cataloged through industry jokes. The other three billionaires for luxury yachts, the other three barrels for offshore energy producers, and the other three battle groups for military customers. Whatever the source, investors saw that there was real demand for satellite internet access. SES exercised an option to buy a majority stake in O3B in 2016. By then, Wyler was already on his next step up the ladder, with new lessons learned and larger ambitions. O3b's constellation would eventually grow to 14 satellites in medium Earth orbit, which limited its service area to a wide band around the equator. The benefit of flying that low was faster service, since the signals would need to travel tens of thousands of miles less than those from the geostationary satellites providing most terrestrial internet access. What if you doubled down on the concept to create a constellation of internet broadcasting satellites in low Earth orbit? To provide anywhere near constant coverage over a wide area would require hundreds, if not thousands, of satellites swarming the globe so that, at any given moment, a handful would be within reach of a user on the ground. For context, there are just over 1,400 operational satellites in orbit right now, and the largest privately owned communications satellite constellation doesn't boast more than 100. This was not just any big idea. It was nearly the same big idea behind Teledesic and the other satellite constellations of the 90s, which had cost their investors billions of dollars and ended in bankruptcy. It had also indirectly blown up the EELV program, which had counted on a burgeoning satellite business to keep its rocket makers in the black. This is exactly the kind of pipe dream we have seen before. Satellite consultant Roger Roush told the Wall Street Journal in 2014, predicting that the costs and delays of such plans would far outstrip early projections. Wyler didn't see it that way. Since the 90s, he told me, technical advances had cut huge chunks of risk out of a business plan that would still require billions of dollars to build and launch the satellites. He ticks them off. The miniaturization of chips and batteries, the improvements in solar panel technology, advances in satellite antennae, the lower cost of launches promised by companies like SpaceX, and the increased demand for and value of data transmission. Wyler brought his idea to Google. The company had already shown an interest in satellite internet, and by 2013, it had $50 billion in cash on hand. If any firm had the hubris and the resources to launch its own satellite constellation, it would be the Search Kings of Mountain View, California. They hired Wyler to explore the possibilities of the scheme, and he worked with Google for months on a plan for a billion-dollar satellite scheme. He left in 2014 in an apparent dispute over the reach of the program and the software-driven company's unwillingness to make the upfront investments in advanced manufacturing technology needed to produce the satellites. Afterwards, Wyler made a beeline to another irrepressible salesman with a taste for big projects, Elon Musk. The two men talked about how SpaceX, with its proven ability to innovate in space hardware manufacturing, could build its own satellite network to sell internet access around the world. Wyler had more than just his ideas to offer. Through a company he created called Worldview, he owned rights granted by the International Telecommunications Union to use a key chunk of radio spectrum. Part of the spectrum, known as the Ku band, it allowed super high-frequency transmissions that enable the use of small antennae on the ground. If his company could put the frequency into operation by 2019, he would have exclusive rights to use it around the globe, pending permission from local telecom regulators. SpaceX could be just the partner needed to manufacture and launch satellites quickly and cheaply enough for the business case to close. So the question that needs to be asked is, why would SpaceX, in the middle of at least three major technology development projects, a crewed spacecraft, a reusable rocket, and a reusable heavy rocket, decide to invest in a whole new line of business? The answer, of course, is money. The earnings generated by satellite constellations shifting data around the planet dwarfed those of the rockets that launched them. The canny entrepreneur could see a path up the value chain, enabled by the savings of using his own rockets. In a sense, this would not be a departure. In the Dragon, SpaceX had already built an autonomous spacecraft that could survive in orbit and communicate with ground stations. It would simply need to make hundreds more that were simpler, smaller Dragons. Satellites constitute as much or more of the cost of space-based activity as the rockets do, Musk said of the venture. Very often, actually, the satellites are more expensive than the rocket. So in order for us to really revolutionize space, we have to address both satellites and rockets. But the partnership between Wyler and Musk was not to be. Disagreements over how far to push the technology in the network drove their split. Greg and I have a fundamental disagreement about the architecture, Musk told a Bloomberg reporter at the time. We want a satellite that is an order of magnitude more sophisticated than what Greg wants. I think there should be two competing systems. They went their separate ways as competitors, each intending to make his own satellite vision a reality. Wyler formed a new company called OneWeb to develop a system for the WorldView spectrum. In 2015, Musk opened a new office outside Seattle that would be dedicated to developing his satellite technology. The separation between Wyler and Musk was not without acrimony. Telecom insiders pointed to a filing registered at the International Telecommunication Union in June 2014 for Ku-band satellite spectrum. Its particulars, including a 4,000 satellite constellation, aligned with SpaceX's plans. Part of the issue is the original filings that Musk made were in late June last year when he was still in discussion with Wyler about collaborating. Tim Farrar, a satellite consultant who worked on Teledesic, told me. Wyler's team might have the upper hand. His rights to those frequencies give him an advantage for winning business and investment around the world. In the United States, an important market for any global telecommunications concern, telecom regulators will likely force competitors who can use the same frequencies to work out a plan to share them, but only once both competitors can demonstrate working systems. That means another race will take place, this time to get an operational constellation swarming in low Earth orbit. In part, to circumvent Wyler's advantage in radio spectrum, SpaceX's satellite team is working on linking its satellites together in an advanced laser communication network, another technical risk to introduce into an already complicated plan. A huge challenge for both endeavors will be creating the software to keep hundreds of satellites handing off signals between one another and with the ground. Like everything SpaceX is doing, the satellite gambit has implications for reaching Mars in the decades ahead. If expanding into satellites made sense from a technical point of view, the possibility of turning the profits to fund the company's larger ambitions in the solar system made it irresistible. This is intended to generate a significant amount of revenue and help fund a city on Mars, Musk said when he opened his satellite office for satellites, adding with his usual dumb-it-down perceptiveness, "What's needed to create a city on Mars? Well, one thing's for sure, a lot of money." Another thing that Musk will need is a space communications network that will allow his space vehicles to communicate with one another and the Earth. This constellation could be the basis for that. Musk and Wyler estimate that their systems will each cost more than $10 billion, an enormous sum to gamble on a high-tech venture, especially considering that if both succeed, they may very well split the market, to both companies' detriment. The satellite community was already worried about the growing problem of space traffic management and the endless debris generated by decades of human activity in space. The U.S. Air Force spends hundreds of millions of dollars to monitor orbital junk, sending a heads-up to satellite operators or the ISS whenever they forecast a collision. The kind of chain reaction catastrophe depicted in the movie Gravity, where debris tears through the ISS, remains a real risk that space agencies around the world pay attention to. Experts say it is already apparent that new technologies to reutilize or remove space debris and new practices to keep orbital lanes clear will be needed. A surge in orbital satellites representing many times the current orbital population will stress an already stressed system of space traffic control. Whatever the risks, both entrepreneurs' track records allowed them to raise the funds for their projects. Investors were once again assigning fantastic values to technology ventures. In 2015, SpaceX won its largest single investment ever, $1 billion, in a round led by Google, which purchased 10% of the firm. While the money wasn't earmarked for the satellite scheme, financial documents leaked to the Wall Street Journal at the time of the investment showed that SpaceX was expecting to generate $15 to $20 billion in revenue from the constellation by 2025. Those same documents showed how tight the company's financial situation had been in the years before, as its products began to come online. It would take years for SpaceX to recoup its investments in technology development. Google's decision to back Musk's space dreams didn't prevent Wyler from assembling his own cadre of industry backers. These included Qualcomm, which manufactures microchips used in satellites, and Airbus, the European aerospace champion, which wanted to develop mass production techniques for satellites. Like rockets, most satellites are assembled by hand in clean rooms, which is one reason for their expense. Intelsat, another major operator in communications satellites, invested as well, perhaps hoping to ape SES's successful incorporation of O3b into its collection of space assets. In 2016, OneWeb would win its own $1 billion investment from the Japanese conglomerate SoftBank, whose tycoon CEO, Masayoshi-san, was spearheading a $100 billion technology investment fund. And because every space venture needs a space billionaire, Richard Branson threw his hat in the ring, investing in OneWeb through Virgin Group and joining its board. The deal also entailed a contract to launch 10 of the satellites on Virgin Orbit, a subsidiary of Virgin Galactic that would be spun out in 2017. Virgin Orbit intended to build the architecture to launch small satellites on rockets dropped at high altitude from a 747. A similar system, called Pegasus, had been operated by Orbital since 1990, but it had proven too expensive to win much business. The idea now was for Virgin to take this architecture and run it through the cost-cutting ringer SpaceX had used to disrupt ULA, in part with some of the same engineers who had helped SpaceX do that. Virgin Orbit's rocket would aim to reinvigorate the small satellite market that had attracted the Falcon 1, rather than face off against SpaceX or United Launch Alliance directly. They weren't the only company aiming at this market. In 2016, Cantrell and Garvey founded their own firm, Vector Space Systems, to launch a new generation of privately funded small satellites, part of a resurgence in small rocket startups. "I don't think Elon can do a competing thing," Branson said of the two internet satellite schemes. "Greg has the spectrum rights, and there isn't space for another network, like there physically is not enough space. If Elon wants to get into this area, the logical thing for him would be to tie up with us." When I asked Wyler about such a link-up, the pragmatic entrepreneur offered a verbal shrug. "My crystal ball is broken. Nothing is off the table. The mission is to connect people." Chapter 16. Beyond Earth Orbit. Water in space is the new oil. George Sowers. The gold rush in space started the moment when Jeff Bezos announced the Blue Moon program, space engineer and Bezos collaborator Joel Sercell told me. The second wealthiest person in the history of humanity staked out a claim on the ring of Shackleton Crater. Blue Moon was Blue Origin's first truly outlandish space business pitch. As the name implies, the company proposed sending a lander back to the lunar surface, which could make it the first private company to touch down on an astronomical body. Since Sercel told me that, Bezos had become the wealthiest man in the world in one heady day of stock trading driven by a particularly possessive Amazon earnings announcement. Why shouldn't the richest man on Earth have a moon base? By 2016, Amazon was one of the most powerful companies in human history, simultaneously mastering logistics, retail, and software tools to earn hundreds of billions of dollars each year. Even though for years Amazon had plowed almost all of its profits back into expansion, its stock was a Wall Street favorite because it grew up like some terrifying science fiction blob, eating entire industries in a gulp. This led investors to overlook various controversies at the company, like antitrust disputes with book publishers, armies of low-wage temps at its distribution centers, and privacy questions about its always-listening home assistants. Whatever doubts may have nagged them about the future consequences of Amazon deals, consumers consistently rated Bezos's Everything store the most well-regarded among the tech giants. That was the year Bezos told reporters the business model behind Blue Origin. I sell about $1 billion of Amazon stock a year and use it to invest in Blue Origin. This wasn't entirely true. According to his SEC filings, Bezos hadn't come close to selling that much equity since 2010, the year that coincides with the company's reinvigoration. He did make good on his promise in 2016 and 2017, however, selling more than $1 billion in stock both years. And for the first time, he was forthcoming about where the money was going. 2 weeks after the Falcon 9 caught fire, Bezos announced that Blue would be building the world's largest orbital rocket, which he dubbed the New Glenn. Like the New Shepard, it was named after an American space pioneer, John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth. Blue's new rocket would be its first to reach orbit. The New Glenn that Bezos described would be huge. In its first iteration, 283 feet tall with a fairing 23 feet in diameter and about three times more lifting power than the Falcon 9, the biggest rocket since the gigantic Saturn V that carried Americans to the moon. The New Glenn's booster stage would be reusable, incorporating what the company had learned from flying the New Shepard, and it would fly into the air on the rocket engine Blue was making for United Launch Alliance, the BE-4. I don't know how anybody is going to be able to compete fundamentally. If you don't have a reusable rocket, Blue CEO Smith told me, describing his vision of New Glenn capturing a large part of the launch market, from NASA to national security to commercial satellites. SpaceX's team was hardly surprised, but the news caused some anxiety at ULA, which now would be buying the single most important technology for its primary product from a direct competitor. Smith says this kind of awkward cross-collaboration is a part of the tightly knit aerospace industry, conceding that it's not the clearest thing, but we know that it's pragmatic at this point. George Sowers, the former ULA executive who helped spearhead the engine partnership between his company and Blue Origin, told me that his board wondered about the possibility of direct competition. He replied that the only thing they've ever launched is the New Shepard. It's a rocket that can't even get to orbit. It's a rocket that would fit inside an Atlas payload fairing. We could launch intact to orbit on an Atlas. But now, Bezos was plotting a rocket that, if not capable of carrying the Atlas, at least dwarfed it. Blue expects to fly this huge rocket for the first time before the end of the decade. Sowers, a veteran of rocket design who masterminded the Atlas V, is skeptical. He noted that SpaceX had gone from a small orbital rocket to a small version of the Falcon 9, which it upgraded several times more before it reached its current size and capacity. Skipping ahead to a monster rocket would be much more difficult. "It would be nuts to try and do it that way," he told me. Bezos, on the other hand, sees his approach as fairly straightforward. "In the long run, deliberate and methodical wins the day, and you do things quickest by never skipping steps," he wrote in one email to fans, noting that his company had spent 4 years designing the huge rocket.